Morning, Council. As you're setting up, I'll call the next case. It is A23-1185. In re the estate of Margaret Peddler, you can correct my pronunciation, Council, Bush, AKA Margaret Bush, deceased. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Council for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The podium toggles up and down with a toggle switch that's in the center and down below. So, Council for appellant, if you want to begin, I ask you both, when you start, to state your name, the party you represent for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Kemp, K-E-M-P. I'm here with Nikki Bonin, and we represent the appellant. We would like to request the 5 minutes for rebuttal,
Your Honor. You have it as a matter of course. So 15 and 5 is what you have.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The rules governing the disclosures related to an antenuptial agreement are easy and simple to follow. This case presents the court with an opportunity to determine what should happen when a party to an antenuptial agreement fails those simple, easy to follow steps. In September of 2002, Margaret Peddler, the decedent, took her soon-to-be husband, David Bush, to her attorney's office. She presented him with an antenuptial agreement, which he willingly signed. It's undisputed in this case that that agreement did not properly disclose two-thirds of her assets, almost $625,000, the vast majority of what she owned or had an interest in. The parties, by all accounts, took this antenuptial agreement, put it in a drawer, and never thought about it again for almost a 20-year marriage until Ms. Peddler Bush died. And at that time, the personal representative hired by Ms. Bush's family advanced the antenuptial agreement. And the court below was asked to rule on whether it was procedurally and substantively fair.
So, Mr. Kemp, if I may, I mean, you talked about the disclosures, but don't we have to look at your client's testimony in depositions where he talked about his general awareness of, you know, the money her family had, you know, the fact that she's a beneficiary and kind of and part of some of these trusts? I mean, we've got that testimony too, not just what was attached to the antinuptial contract. Don't we have to weigh that just as much, if not more?
I wouldn't say more. I would say just as much. It's certainly evidence, the same as any other evidence. And, Your Honor, that takes me to the first of the three issues I want to address. Let me give a little roadmap, and then I'll get directly into the answer. The court below erred to determine that the antinuptial agreement was valid. And we've laid out in our brief the reasons for that. I want to focus on three. The first one is you just talked about, is a full and fair disclosure. How do we look at that? What is the law on that? And why did the court err to determine there's full and fair disclosure? And then having answered that, I want to go on to two more issues, the issue of whether there was adequate consideration in this case and whether there was substantive fairness at the time of the enforcement of the agreement. So, Your Honor, let's turn first to that full and fair disclosure. What does that mean? And as we've laid out in case law, it doesn't necessarily mean that literally every single item that a person has needs to be listed out in a written agreement.
Is Your Honor correctly? We do look at the tax return that was attached, right?
What's that?
We do look at the tax return that was attached to the antenuptial agreement.
We can look at the document itself. We can look at attachments to the document. And absolutely, we can look at somebody's actual knowledge. All of those could be fair and full disclosures.
But if we consider that whole group, what wasn't disclosed?
The value of the Hardy Kern LLC. So assuming that we can get to the fact that the Hardy Kern LLC was something she had an ownership interest in, what did that ownership interest mean? What was its value? In fact, that was
just the value of the LLC, that's it.
No, that's one of them. There's two more. The two other trusts, the DM Hardy Trust and Edith Kern, both of those were undisclosed. Together, they had a value that, according to David Pedler, who was the previous personal representative, he couldn't give us a good answer because nobody actually listed the value in those documents, and nobody knew because the trust had actually been dissolved in 2010. But he gave us his best guess that they were worth...
You've already confused me because you're talking about 2010, but this agreement was signed in what, 2002?
2002, Your Honor.
So the disclosure should have taken place in 2002, and there was a disclosure. I don't want to say there wasn't. Right, you're talking about adequacy of the disclosure.
That's a fair distinction, right. Your Honor. So we're talking about, are things properly disclosed?
Right. So why are we talking about 2010 when it comes to the value?
Because the 2010 value is the best number we have, because
of what it was worth in 2002.
Of what these two, of what it was worth in 2010.
Right. That's my point. I don't know. Maybe I'm not following your argument, counsel, but it seems to me that you are looking at a continuum of things, which would obviously then include Mr. Bush's knowledge, but which, you know, that makes sense to me in light of the case law. But I'm struggling with your point that at the time the antenuptial agreement was made, that there wasn't a full or adequate disclosure.
And the court's confusion mirrors that of really the parties in the case, none of whom can look back and say, what was this worth? The best number we have of these two trusts was what they were worth in 2010, and they were worth $700,000.
But if you have an interest in something and that's disclosed, like if I had a premarital, non-marital interest in Apple stock in the year 2000, and I disclosed that, and it takes off astronomically by the end, I've still disclosed. Like, it's not like I had to have disclosed in 2002 that my Apple stock is going to be worth X in 2022. I don't know that. You know, so, I mean, if you disclose an interest in a business, if you disclose a value or, you know, beneficiary interest in a trust, you're saying you have to disclose the dollar value at that time, and that was not disclosed at that time, regardless of what it becomes later? I mean...
Absolutely correct.
So the 2010 beneficiary interest in the trust wouldn't be... Why is that relevant?
Because it's the closest we have to what the actual value was in 2002. And, Your Honor, this gets back to the very first point I made. Why do we have these disclosures? Why should we, even though we're not required to, why should we have these in writing? Because now 21 years later, 22 years later almost, we're trying to go back and unwind what the value was.
I'm just struggling with your quest to know or to have them know then of what some precise value was because of the Hill case is one of them, which says that someone's general knowledge of the financial conditions enough. They lived together before they were married. If you look at his testimony, he seemed to have that general knowledge of her financial situation. Why isn't that enough?
Because what the statute says is fair and full disclosure. And the problem, Your Honor, with that is that we have this strict requirement. And what we're seeing, and one of the troubling parts about respondents' case, is that we're seeing from that tag that the legislature has put down, this is what we need, fair and full disclosure, a sort of derogation where we say it doesn't have to be fair and full, general knowledge is enough. And it doesn't have to be general knowledge in writing, general knowledge in maybe somebody's testimony or their understanding.
Are you saying Hill versus Hill isn't good law? Because, I mean, this statute, that language in the statute has been around for a while.
It has, Your Honor. But what I'm cautioning the court against is these incremental moves where each time we get and this is, of course, the problem with living under a common law system. We've got the statute, and each case looks at the facts presented, the unique facts presented, just as this court is doing, and decides, well, that's pretty close. Hill says this disclosure that we have on the unique facts presented is pretty close to the statute. We're not going to invalidate the agreement on that. Pollock Halverson does the same sort of thing. Well, okay, there wasn't a full and fair disclosure of everything, but it doesn't have to be literally everything. It's close enough.
So, counsel, if I may, and I just given our limited time, and I know you wanted to talk about consideration, I'm not trying to stop you, but I do have a couple of questions about the substantive fairness and enforcement, if I can. Go ahead to your third point.
Yes, sure.
Okay. just one clarification first. Are you or are you not also saying the district court should have addressed substantive fairness at the enactment, at the signing? I mean, just a question. If we say, we decide we agree with you and we need to remand it, are we saying you have to look at it at substantive fairness at enactment or only, because you just said you want to talk about substantive fairness at enforcement. So help me.
It would be both, Your Honor. So let's move to that third point.
Okay, great. So I'm just struggling with part of this language from the McGee-Johnson case, which I know you're familiar with, towards the end of that case, which seems to say that when we're talking about that evaluating the substantive fairness and enforcement, it seems to say isn't automatic. There needs to be changed circumstances so as to trigger a further substantive fairness review. Are you familiar with that part of that language in the case?
I'm familiar with that, Your Honor.
Okay, great. So my question is twofold. One, what have you said is that trigger, that change circumstances, which would trigger us to do that substantive fairness review from enforcement? Because I see you talking about abandonment, but the other change circumstances weren't as clear to me, so that's my question number one. And two, you know, is that something that we should be looking at? We have de novo review. You know, should we just be looking at that, or do we absolutely have to send it back to the district court from your perspective?
Appellant's position, Your Honor, is that for the reason we didn't move for summary judgment ourselves on this, is that those are fact issues.
But you have to bring up facts to resist summary judgment, so I'm just trying to focus on what those facts are.
Yes, and the facts here are the abandonment. We agree that one of the circumstances that can trigger a substantive fairness at the time of enforcement analysis, one of those triggers could be significantly changed circumstance such that an agreement that might have been or seemed fair at the time of execution no longer seems fair. That would be one trigger. The other is the abandonment. And the fact is there were fact questions about whether the parties had ever abided by the terms of this agreement. In fact, it's pretty clear that Mr. Bush is spending his own money on things that are claimed to be non-marital assets, like the home, paying HOA fees, paying for appliances, paying for landscaping. And the fact that that Ms. Bush, by both her actions and her words, evinced that this was an agreement that had been abandoned. So it's not strictly limited to changed circumstances, Your Honor. Although that is one.
Is there, if I may have one follow-up question? As if we were looking at substantive fairness at enforcement, I would think that we would be looking at the evidence of, you know, does your client have the enough to live on, you know, is that, you know, as we're looking at fairness. And I was struggling in the record to see how much I saw the information about, you know, there were direct, she added him to her bank accounts. But it was not clear to me looking at the record how much that was. So if we were to address substantive fairness, that seems to be fair. But you know the record better than I do.
I'll answer your question by saying
only if it's in the record, though.
I will answer your question by saying that the parties agree that there were these bank accounts and IRAs that were transferred by Ms. Bush to Mr. Bush. I will represent to the court, I think all the parties agree, he's not impoverished. So if the question is, are we asserting a position that he would be left in abject poverty, which obviously would be a substantive fairness at the time of enforcement, the answer to that is no. That's not what we are asserting. So then turning back, if I may, then to the second point, I want to briefly address the adequacy of consideration. One of the Kinney factors as well, and it's part of procedural fairness. Adequacy of consideration looks at what a party is giving up and what they receive. The court in Kramer noted that simply mirror image provisions, each party has agreed to get married and renounce some property of the other, can be patently one-sided. The adequacy of the consideration is something that courts will delve into in a prenuptial agreement.
So, counsel, I have one factual question about the way this agreement works and possible consideration. Is there marital property? Has that determination been made? Because the agreement covers both marital and non-marital property.
Unfortunately, given the procedural posture of the case, the sort of threshold issue was, is this agreement even valid in the first place?
I understand. I still want to know whether there's marital property or is that a hotly disputed issue. Sounds to me like it's disputed.
There is a disputed issue of what is or should be considered marital property.
So I had that, same question, because when one reads the Supreme Court's decision in Kramer, it interpreted the statute, looked at the common law tests, et cetera, and then it said, having done that, having discussed the statute, looked at the, you know, clarified the common law tests, we now evaluate whether the next step for a court, it said, it suggested, I think, is evaluate whether this is a non-marital agreement or marital, or non-marital provisions or marital, and decided that it couldn't tell and that applied the standard accordingly. So I'm not sure, and I'm going over a little bit here, so please answer. I'm not sure why, I think the district court, I was just looking for it, but I believe it's somewhere in there, the district court reflected its understanding that the dispute was over non-marital property. I believe it said that, and I wish I could, I flagged it. I'm not seeing it right now. You're telling me that there's some dollar values, I guess, some property in dispute that's marital. Or are you not telling me that, that it's premature to decide? Because when I read Kramer, I think it possibly said that evaluating the standard for evaluating, the test for evaluating the validity and enforceability of an antenuptial agreement is applied by first looking at, are we talking about non-marital? Are we talking about marital? So I'm not sure why it's a premature, seems, why you say it's not timing-wise the time for it.
Let me answer the question as briefly as I can because I know the time's run out, but the court has asked a procedurally complicated question. So in order to determine whether under the safe harbor provisions or whether we're under Kramer, the court would look at the provisions, each provision of the antenuptial agreement, and determine whether it covers marital or non-marital property. If it covers only non-marital property, that provision is analyzed under 51911. If that provision does not meet that safe harbor under 51911, or marital property is covered, then we get into Kinney with regard to those provisions. Now, what the court said in the exact language from the court's order was it was the court's understanding that the vast majority of the assets of the estate were non-marital, which is true. There are what appellant would assert to be marital assets, including something like the home. So what the court should do is look at the particular provisions, look at the statutory definition under 518.003, subdivision 3B. That says whether something is marital or non-marital. You're not looking to the individual contract. You're looking to whether the provisions apply to something that statutorily would be marital or non-marital. And if it's valid, then the court will accept, as it would in any other contract, the party's derogation or their new definitions of what's marital and non-marital, because that's the point
of it. So did the district court error in not doing that here?
That was not the root of the court's error, Your
Honor. But whether it was the root of it or not, should it, did it do it here? And was, I guess I'm, what,
no,
what
Your Honor,
non-marital, what, excuse me, marital property, well,
the
there's so many questions, but what marital property are you disputing that he should have? Let me put it that way.
The easiest answer is the home, Your
the
Honor,
home.
The home they
okay.
lived in together.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you'll have time for rebuttal, and we certainly will give fair time to everyone, both sides on this. So I know we went a little over, so counsel for respondent.
All right. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the personal representative of the estate of Margaret Peddler Bush. And I think I'll just start off where appellant left off with the question of, is there actually marital property in dispute? I think that's an important question. And I think on at this posture, on summary judgment, it's their obligation to identify some marital property that's in dispute. It's certainly not the assets from her family business because those were clearly non-marital under any definition. And it can't be the home either because she owned that before the marriage. And it's very clear in the antenuptial agreement that that's to stay non-marital property. So because there hasn't been any identification of any specific asset that would be marital property, I think the trial court's analysis in not going on to the substantive fairness part of it is proper, and there's no error in that.
So at summary judgment, you're saying the burden was on the appellant to identify the marital property either in the agreement or, I guess, more at issue now.
Right. When he's trying to oppose summary judgment, he has to identify some sort of fact dispute or some sort of reason not to grant summary judgment. And one way to do that would be to identify a marital asset that requires a different test. But that hasn't occurred.
But why does that directly affect the need to address substantive fairness? I mean, because saying that we agree with you as in point of marital property, so you have a though there's that provision in the contract, right, that talks about marital property and how it would be dealt with.
Correct.
But you're jumping from that to saying, so we don't need to address substantive fairness, and Kramer versus Kramer says, you know, we've got to evaluate antenuptial agreements to be fair both procedurally and substantively, and says this, you know, safe harbor just is dealing with procedural fairness.
Kramer says that because it finds that it did not satisfy the statutory safe harbor, and so it considers both procedural and substantive fairness under Kinney. But Kramer is clear, if it satisfies the statutory safe harbor, then that ends the analysis. Then you don't go on to procedural fairness.
I would agree that Kramer, there's a language in the Kramer that would support just what you said. Kind of the language says then, you know, the non-marital property are automatically valid. That
yes.
Language I assume you're referring to. But there's also this, you know, the language saying you've got to be fair both substantively and procedurally, and the statute only deals with procedure. How do we not have some obligation to at least, and maybe it's just, which I think you argue in your brief, is a substantive review and enforcement triggered, but have to look at the substance?
Right. I mean, my reading of the plain text of the statute itself also says it's a safe, it shall be valid and enforceable if these procedural requirements are met. So that ends the analysis if it meets the statutory safe harbor. Now, I understand if it doesn't meet the statutory safe harbor, then we go on to Kinney and you consider substantive fairness. But there's no substantive fairness review required if it meets the procedural safe harbor under the statute. So I want to talk about the disclosures as well. There's the requirement for full and fair disclosure has never been interpreted as appellant is requesting that there be a long list of the value of every single asset when there's general knowledge that these people, you know, live together. He admits in his deposition testimony that he was aware that she had a membership interest in this LLC/trust, which they referred to interchangeably. This is an experienced 60-year-old man. He's been through divorce before. He has a general understanding of how these things work. And notably, you know, he could have asked questions. He could have asked for more information when he sees that she's getting quarterly distributions. He could have asked about what the principal value is. There's nothing to suggest that she would have hidden that from him. And so when you have the disclosure of what the quarterly distributions are, you have his knowledge that she was a member with her siblings in the LLC. He says he thinks the agreement is very fair. He states he was going to marry her regardless. This should all be sufficient to satisfy fair and adequate disclosure. The whole point of the requirement for full and fair disclosure is some concern that they would have made a different decision if disclosures had been different. I think the record here is clear that would not have occurred. He was going to marry her. He was fine with the agreement protecting her family assets from spouses.
But the full disclosure, I mean, if it had been nothing and the person said, I would have married anyway, is that full and fair disclosure? If the person didn't put any, didn't identify the assets at all, notwithstanding having a bunch? I mean, that seems like a lot to an outcome to come to. I mean, I guess the question here is there were really specific values given to some things, yet the most valuable things, you have to infer from the tax reports there's an ownership interest in something. It's not even actually listed, the ownership interest, right?
Well, I think the case law that we have looks at, whether there was, misleading going on, and even some case law talks about whether it's, intentionally deceptive. And I think this is how she viewed the asset. She viewed it as quarterly income. She because that's how their family was raised, to treat this asset as quarterly income. So,
right, but the agreement includes the ownership interest. So if that's not even in her mind as to that I'm disclosing the ownership interest, isn't that a problem of disclosure then?
I don't think so, because, again, he was aware that she had an ownership interest, and it's very clear from the tax returns as well that that she has an ownership interest. It's listed there. He had every opportunity to review the documents. He had every opportunity to ask questions. If he chose not to, I mean, I don't think that willful blindness is a reason to avoid your obligations that under an nuptial agreement that you voluntarily entered into. So I think under the case law, this is well within the bounds of full and fair disclosure, given his knowledge at the time.
Why isn't that at least a factual dispute? You're sort of talking about this is on summary judgment, right? You're talking about what's in her mind, what she thought, what she probably thought from that, and
Well, there are no facts in dispute. It's not a he said, she said, because she's not here to testify. So all we have is his testimony. We're accepting every word that comes out of his mouth as true. Those are the facts. I think the question where the debate is where do those facts lead us in terms of a legal conclusion? But that's not a fact dispute. That's not something to preclude summary judgment. We accept what he's saying about what he knew. Because she's not here to say otherwise.
So let me follow up on that. So if we agreed with appellant that there that perhaps a substantive fairness review, at least at enforcement, was necessary, would there be facts in dispute regarding that, or as opposed to something that there's no dispute, so we could address that perhaps ourselves?
I don't think there are facts in dispute regarding substantive fairness at the time of enforcement. Because I think it would be his burden on summary judgment to show that there's been changed circumstances. The substantive fairness review at time of enforcement is limited to some changed circumstances, and I don't think there's been any showing here that, other than her dying, which of course was a possibility at any time, that anything has changed. So you know that. It's also undisputed that he has the accounts that were transferred on her death. I think I heard today it's undisputed that he's not going to be impoverished. So the cases where we've seen a substantive fairness review at the time of enforcement hold an antenuptial agreement invalid are not going to be things that any facts here could rise to that level.
What about the argument that I read in a summary judgment motion repeated here, which is that, I contributed the house, even though the house was listed as non-marital. I contributed to other things that I didn't have to do under the understanding that we had sort of abandoned this, at least with respect to the house. I don't know with respect to the rest. We had abandoned the antenuptial agreement. And I made decisions about my money accordingly. I didn't invest in my own retirement. Use the money that I spent toward the house and instead invest my own retirement, et cetera. Those are changed circumstances by virtue of the conduct that, my wife and I engaged in, which seemed to disregard the agreement.
There can't be changed circumstances by way of abandonment because there is no such thing as abandonment of an antenuptial contract under Minnesota law unless you go through the formalities in the statute to revoke it.
But why does it have to be legal abandonment? Why can't it be, let's say he had, been paying a mortgage and been paying all the, repair on the house and all the things that normally the homeowner would do and expect to do. Does it have to come to legal abandonment, or can't that just be a course of conduct that suggested to me that I was going to get the house? And even, you know, I know that there's a debate about whether the letters would be admissible, whereas, you know, the later letters, which I think the argument is they confirmed his understanding by course of conduct that he was going to get the house.
I don't think there's any case law that has ever followed that type of analysis. I would point out that the antenuptial agreement contemplates that the parties might give gifts to each other throughout. There's nothing that's contrary to the terms of their agreement and what they've done. I think it's actually notable, you know, what they did not do. I mean, she never revoked the antenuptial agreement, never executed a will, she added him to some bank accounts but not others. And when she thought she was going to die, she brought her personal property to her brother's house. So if there's some sort of argument that she would have wanted or would have intended to leave all of her property, all of her assets to Mr. Bush, I think that's in significant tension with what her actions actually were.
Well, couldn't that be a factual dispute then that goes to trial?
Well, there's no factual dispute, though, because we know what she did and didn't do. It's just a question of where that leads us in terms of a legal conclusion.
So let me see if I just understand what you're saying. Your basic argument on this is that because commingling was anticipated, that unless they choose to establish, you know, because commingling was anticipated by the agreement, that can't be a change in circumstances which would trigger substantive review. Is that basically
correct?
It?
Okay. Correct. Yes. And I would note, too, you know, he always knew that he had this antenuptial agreement. And when she died, it was found, you know, fairly quickly. And so if they had at any point wanted to abandon it, wanted to change it, they certainly could have. And they didn't do that. And so now what we have to do is we have to go back to the antenuptial agreement as the only evidence of, you know, what she would have wanted, because that's what she agreed to and what he agreed to. And so...
Well, I'm just thinking of Kramer. I mean, one of the things, as I recall in Kramer, looking at substantive fairness, is the wife's contribution to, you know, the business of running the farm, even though the farm was not hers under the antenuptial. So I looked at the course of conduct between the parties and the assets that had been, you know, she wouldn't be entitled to under the antenuptial agreement.
But that was under a substantive fairness review, and that was, importantly, contributed to the main asset, which was at issue. And here, there's no argument that Mr. Bush contributed to the LLC or the trust. And so that's where, what he wants to get.
What about the home?
I think you then go back to the fact that, you know, the home, yes, was hers legally, but he was allowed to live in it rent-free. And so it's not like he was doing this out of the you know, the goodness of his heart for nothing in exchange. I mean, he was improving his own living situation at the same time. And so that, again, you know, with the fact that commingling is considered throughout the antenuptial agreement, that can't be a changed circumstance here. I guess just briefly I'll touch on consideration, because that was the other point that was brought up. Consideration, we have two ways to find it here. One is the mutual exchange of promises. And I think it is significant that everyone thought that Mr. Bush was going to die first. And if he had done so, Mrs. Bush was giving up, she was agreeing to split the marital assets 50-50 with his children. So that is something that's significant and an exchange of value that should support consideration. Also, the marriage itself can be consideration when he has independent means. Nothing in the case law says that means he has to be wealthy, just that, you know, he can generally support himself. And he did here. He supported himself for 60 years before they were married. That is very different than the cases where it's a woman who is going to be left penniless with multiple children to feed. And so in these circumstances, the marriage itself can be considered adequate consideration. And we would just ask that the court affirm in all aspects. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing some of the points that were brought up, let me start with a question about the home. As my colleague just pointed out, in the agreement itself, it was clear in that agreement this was intended to be a non-marital asset. And so what we look at is, Judge Smith, as you pointed out, a course of performance we can look at under Kramer and see what the parties actually did, right? Back in contract law, we might consider that a condition subsequent. Did the parties actually do what the agreement said to do, like keep their finances separate with regard to non-marital assets? And the answer here is clearly no. They both paid for the home. He paid homeowner's fees. She paid the mortgage. He paid for landscaping. She may have done repairs. He did some repairs. This is all part of evidence that the parties had abandoned the agreement, because this agreement for 20 years.
Well, at least with respect to the home. I think I just heard this has nothing to do with the other non-marital assets, that he didn't contribute to them at all. Why would that mean that the whole agreement disappears?
It's if the parties have abandoned the agreement.
So you would in fact rely on the legal doctrine of abandonment. So we would actually have to find that satisfied here, as opposed to what I was sort of just asking about. Well, do you have to actually go there, or can't we just sort of look at a changed circumstance and determine whether
I think you can
there.
You can do either one, Your Honor, because the court could look at whether the parties had evidenced an abandonment of agreement. That's different from rescinding it or revoking it. And you can go to that level and say the parties never followed this agreement, never in 20 years. And she indicated that she didn't want to. She put all the bank accounts in his name. The pay-on-death accounts, or IRAs, she wrote these letters. Again, there's a dispute about whether they will ultimately be admissible. But every piece of evidence says they never, not once, abided by the terms of this agreement.
What does that mean when the agreement contemplated they could commingle, the agreement permitted gifts? Why does that mean it's not in accordance with to give a spouse, put a spouse on a, you know, as a beneficiary of a bank account, for example? It doesn't violate the agreement. She could choose to do that, right?
The agreement did say that they could create a joint account for joint expenses. But what we're seeing is not that, right?
Could she not give him money, make him beneficiary of one of her bank accounts on death if she chose to? Did that violate the agreement, you know, not in accordance with the agreement?
I wouldn't say that wasn't in accordance with the agreement. I think she could have done that under a valid agreement, or she could have done that because, as evidenced by these letters, she didn't believe that that agreement was something that they had lived by, once something that she wanted to happen. And over the course of a marriage, something like a home that may start out to be non-marital may become marital, because the parties have chosen to abandon that designation, as is true in this case. And so it becomes marital property. And so then, Judge Smith, you get to this sort of less extreme option of saying, all right, maybe we don't say, even if we don't think that the entire agreement was abandoned, we at least have fact questions about whether the individual provisions or individual assets were treated as they were supposed to be treated by this contract in 2002. And if they weren't, then it would be improper to take the party's 20-year marriage and throw out all that conduct because of something they did in 2002 that then they consistently violated. I want to move on to the full and fair disclosure, because I noticed some language from my colleague as she was arguing this case that really struck me. A couple of things she said show that she's shifting the burden, because a party propounding an agreement has a duty to disclose their assets. And what you heard from the other side is that he was willfully blind, that he had obligations to go and dig out her assets, but that's not what the duty is. She had easy, simple obligations, and she failed to meet them. And for that reason, the court below erred. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your briefing. Thank you for your arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you.